I'm Erica Wise, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit michters.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and we have a very special guest today. We have a winemaker from Mount Etna, the largest active volcano in Europe. I always think that it's very courageous for people to live and work and make beautiful wines on an active volcano. We have Mr. Frank Cornelissen here in the studio with us. Frank, welcome to In the Drink.
Thank you, Joe.
Now, Frank's wines have been popping up quite a bit on our radio show recently. We had George Hawk from Barquetta tell us how much he loved your wines. Francine Stevens and Luca Pasquinelli from Franny's and Marco's were just gushing over your wines. And I'm a really big fan of them as well. We have them on our wine list at Dell'Anima and Anfora. And Lartuzzi, we absolutely love your wines. And the big thing that a lot of people are talking about is how your wines have been evolving and changing. I think when they first came to New York, everyone got really excited about them, but they were different than they are now. And tell us about how you've approached this and how your philosophy on wine has changed over the years.
Well, basically, the philosophy didn't change at all. It's just that evolution is something and natural also with persons. I think there is a maturation point where I think a person changes and there is experience and which you accumulate over the years, especially if you want to do artisan winemaking. You improve, you accumulate, and whether you like it or not, your craft and information, and you apply that to make always better wines. And so, let's say, basically, in vinification, we didn't do anything different. I'm still working as I did. The only thing, your oxygen management is more precise. Mm-hmm. You understand better your vineyards and the time of picking. The yields gradually actually decreased even, and although they were always quite low, but then they decreased. And so today we work on more surface, 18 hectares compared to half a hectare when we started in 2001, and we have more possibility to select and deselect, let's say.
Yes, and for those of you who don't know Frank's story, I say it's courageous to make wine on an active volcano. It's courageous to move to Mount Etna as a foreigner, as a non-Italian, much less not even a Sicilian, in 2001 on Mount Etna. When I imagine this wasn't a place that that there were many foreigners living.
No, when I arrived in 2001, actually it was December 2000, and there was no foreigner in the valley. And so obviously for local people, it was weird to see somebody that comes from, let's say, the evolved and more economically and wealthier north, and coming to the south and then and working the land and pruning vines like they did for years. And making a wine which was definitely a bit different. Not the wine itself, but maybe the tools using. There were amphoras that were arriving instead of using barrels like local people did. Mm-hmm. But I felt very 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 comfortable, and people were very nice, and they were very gentle also. Always asking like the classic word permesso, and is it possible to enter in your cellar? And because they were curious and seeing like what is this let's say crazy between brackets and a foreign person doing here and with wine.
And which other producers did you kind of instantly click with, share ideas with, befriend?
I think any foreigner who actually came with the idea to make wine seriously, I've always had a very good relationship with. And although my wine techniques are very different than, for example, Andrea Franchetti from Passo Pisciaro or Marco De Grazia from Terra Neri, and we have a great exchange. And many times I dine or have lunch with Marco and as he's living there. And so, but although his wines are let's say different, but we all believe in the greatness of the terroir of Etna.
Yeah, I can't think of a place where you can have three such different wines from the same grape, and I imagine similar terroirs of three of you, because you're all sort of in that Passo Pisciaro area. Is
yes.
that correct?
It's correct. And we have different vineyards and in different locations, although in some cases they're very close. I'm neighbors in one section where I produce Magma, which is called Incontrada Barbabecchi, and where Andrea also makes a wine, which is called the Rampante. And with Marco in Ferro di Mezzo, we also are quite close. So it's it's interesting. It's stimulating in many ways.
So, it just blows my mind that at the same table would be you and Franchetti and Marc de Grazia, and again the wines, Franchetti's wines being so big and powerful and extracted, and sometimes with a good amount of new oak, and de Grazia's really this kind of like soft, elegant, very clean style, also sometimes with some oak, and then yours no oak and these very like alive. Also, like beautiful, lots of energy, and just super unique. Like, I mean, unlike any wine I've ever had, not only from Etna but anywhere. But it's not like Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid hanging out. If I don't know if you get that, it really isn't. You guys all have the same idea in the love of the land, but
yes.
Do it in very different ways.
We believe in the greatness of the territory of Etna, and for example, a few years ago, and I think about 4 years ago, we had a lunch with Marco, and then we pulled open 2002, which was Marco's first wine, and it was my second, and in a period where my wines were highly, let's say, evolved, and they were from day one and quite oxidized in style. And so we opened those wines, obviously, and quite different, and compared to what Marco was doing. But what we what blew us away, both Marco and me, is that there were similarities, which means the greatness of territory. Etna showed more than the winemaking technique in the end, and that is something quite special. And in Etna, and I think we all understand this. Obviously, everybody their own philosophy and way of interpreting the territory. But that was a fantastic experience.
Okay, and the territory is really amazing. If you can talk about a little bit about what you look for when you're acquiring a new vineyard, because. I like to mention how Etna has very old vines, this volcanic soil, which for the most part, and correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't support phylloxera, so you can have ungrafted vines in certain areas, high altitude and a lot of vintage variation. Everything is made there for a quality wine region. But when you're looking for a new vineyard site, what specifically do you look for?
Good question. I always look for great vineyards, but obviously that needs to be defined. And I think the greatness of a vineyard is being able to express in a very specific way the wines. For example, is Burgundy, where there are many Grand Crus and many Premier Crus, but it's not that every single plot of land and is able to express in a very characteristic way the wine. So when you talk about great sites and it's not always easy to find them, but if you recognize them in some kind of wine that has been made in the past from this vineyard, it's something I'm very keen on buying. Mm-hmm. So the exposure, for example, is something very special. if the vines are very old, it's something I look for. And I would prefer personally whether a vineyard is abandoned and then even, let's say, not pruned for 2 or 3 years. And because with 3 or 4 years of good work in it, you can let's say, put the vineyard back into to an original state. So those are obviously investments which need a bit of passion and also time to get there. But for example, the lower part of the vineyard of where we produce Magma, our top wine, was completely abandoned, and it was difficult to see the vines even. But we, in 3 years of time, we brought it back to its original shape, and it looks great now.
And you're saying that's a better situation than if you were to purchase a vineyard that someone had been working, but doing it in a way that you was not in line with your philosophy.
I would personally prefer an abandoned vineyard, yeah. Yes. And even if it would cost me 3 or 4 years, because there will not be an chemistry in it, and obviously the vines need to be retuned and then re-prepared for making great wine. But I prefer to do that than, for example, buy a completely, let's say, devastated piece of land, mm-hmm. with chemistry.
And do abandoned vineyards still exist on Etna, or has everyone kind of picked them over?
They do exist. It's getting rarer by yeah. The last years, and there's been a request for Etna, but let's say the biggest request comes from bare land, which is ripped out and then replanted, and something which hurts me a little bit, and because when you have, for example, very old vines, and then people rip them out to replant in a more modern and economically viable way with rows, and it makes me sad, because the old vines, they have their roots down deep. Somebody planted them, and let's say 60 or 70 years ago, and it makes you feel very very happy also to be able to work with something with heritage from the past, and that is what I prefer to work with.
With, yeah, and I mean, it seems that those wines have more of a story to tell. They've seen a lot more.
Yeah, it's a good way of looking at it. They the heritage means a story, and they also have in a physical way their roots down deep. They can cope with difficult vintages in terms of climate and very dry or rainy. Old vines, it's a bit like making a broth, and then with an old chicken, it's got a better taste in a way than with young vines.
Yeah, and I promise you, I did not prompt Frank to say the word heritage. So your philosophy is based on the idea that your vineyard philosophy, at least, is based on the idea that you can't fully understand the complexity of nature, and therefore you take a more natural or hands-off approach to winemaking. How does that actually come into play, this idea that you can't understand every interaction between nature?
It's basically a philosophical approach, and I don't feel well when people say like, you're a great winemaker, and I think you in life there's the need for humbleness. It's impossible that man understands everything and the creation. I'm raised and I grew up in a family and which was non-religious. Today, it's I changed working the land in terms that God exists, and until let's say the opposite is proven. What or who God might be, it's another issue. But there is something bigger. You see this in the growing process of a vine, and from leaves, and there is fruit, and which is a non-material issue. This photosynthesis, there is an exchange from environment, and it sounds also all a little bit strange. And I'm talking about this, but when you see a vine grow, it brings you fruit, and the fruit changes into a wine which is fermented without any chemistry, and everything is there. It is something very special, and which makes you also very humble. And so, yes, I think there are so many complexities and interactions which go beyond the possibility of man to understand that.
Yeah, and it's a topic that's covered a lot in Dan Barber's book, The Third Plate. I keep bringing it up because I really love this book. He's a chef here, and he has a restaurant in New York City, and then one just north of the city that's on a farm called Blue Hill at Stone Barns. And in the book, he goes to the Dehesa in western Spain, and he visits a farmer who visits someone who makes foie gras without the force feeding, and he visits the jamón ibérico and speaks with farmers who explain to him that if you feed pigs acorns without the acorns ever having fallen on the ground, it's a completely different thing. And there's some way that the acorns then change as soon as they hit the soil, and the pigs are much more attracted to them at that point. And what is it about that? And what I think that's just a really good example of how you can't just distill one part of nature and think you understand all of it. There's so many things that are so interconnected.
Yeah.
They're so interconnected there. Yeah.
It's true. I just wrote an email from somebody who was asking me a question about a technicality. But I replied to the email, and I'm not avoiding the question. But sometimes life is not to be reduced to two or three chemical components, and then which can all be completely perfectly explained. And if you have three components and you all make them interact, you will have hundreds of results and combinations which are possible. And that's what's happening in life. And so there are things which I accept, I need to, because they're part of, call it the divine, the creation. And then there's things that I need to follow up as man, being part of the creation, but I'm not the creation. And so there is a very thin line where I take my hands off, and I'm curious, but I'm much more like like somebody who watches from the outside to what is happening, with very curious and very eager eyes to not to understand, but to see the fascinating thing about what's happening. And so that is part of the winemaking. It's more accompanying than really making, constructing. Mm-hmm. That is my philosophy.
And I imagine this hands-off approach requires a great deal of attention, kind of attention from afar without meddling too much. What do you physically actually need to do to make quality wine that isn't just like letting the grapes fall into a vat? You know, there has to be some kind of interaction between you and the grapes and the wine at some point. Like what is the least that you have to do in order to make a high quality wine?
Well, first of all, there is crop management, and I think it's relatively clear that when you have a little fruit on a vine, you will have a higher concentration, because the vine has a certain amount of energy which goes into two bunches, or whether that same energy goes in is divided over 20 bunches of grapes. So that's the first thing, which doesn't necessarily mean that vine, and here comes the complexity of nature, maybe that vine needs five or six bunches, and because it feels better, and then to produce all its energy and to put it into five bunches, where when you reduce it to one or two, thinking like it's going to be even better, the vine goes into a stress and doesn't know what to do with its energy. And so it's absolutely important, and that is something which I think in France is very much present in the history and the generations of working on the land. If you prune a vine, and people read vines, you just don't go and prune and work in an industrial, let's say, like in a machine way. You look at the vine, you look at the position, and then you prune. You set the vine, but you have to become a little bit vine yourself. That is when you can read nature. The same thing when you want to plant a vineyard, you have to become nearly the land and see how much damage I can handle, and where, at what point it can be restored to nature, where your vineyard becomes integral part of your environment. So you have to be, let's say, very sensitive to mm-hmm. to everything what goes around it. But a quality wine starts with low crop, it goes and, on with the canopy management, how you read the environment, because, you know, sun is a beautiful thing, but it's also an energy which damages. Not enough sun, there's no maturation. Too much sun, and it burns. Mm-hmm. And so everything needs to be read and interpreted, and therefore the manual work in a vineyard, which today many times is exchanged by mechanical work, is very valuable and to get to achieve quality products. Otherwise, everything gets standardized, and then you could have a good medium quality. But exceptional quality is done by man, because you have to interpret, read, and then mm-hmm. act in proportion to what you have in front of you, what the vine is.
So you have to consciously live in sync with nature, and not dominate it, and not be submissive to it, but promote it and let it and it will then promote you by having a great wine.
Absolutely. It's you have to become a part of your environment, and yeah. It's like when we talk terroir, and many times we analyze it like it's soil, it's geology, it's climate, but many times somebody forgets that you, as the interpreter of that terroir, have to become an integral part of that environment. Mm-hmm. And if that becomes the case, then you become also sensitive, and then you can interpret and make in a quality way the product you want to show from that piece of land.
Now, I have to ask you this, because it's a question that I get asked the most, because we have a wine bar called Anfora. And the question that people ask me, and my answer, I'm sure, is going to be as a winemaker, as a sommelier and wine director, it's going to be different from a winemaker's answer. But they ask me, like, what effect does Anfora have on the wine itself? And what I tend to say is, when the winemaker is doing a good job, you don't taste any amphora. You shouldn't taste it. It just kind of amplifies some earthiness to it. But why do you choose to use amphora, and what effect do you find it has on your wines?
The reason why I started to use the amphoras was because it has a beautiful shape. It's round. It's like a womb, and so a wine, when it transforms and when it also wants to rest and goes into its final phase of forming the wine into its final flavors, it is a beautiful and a place to sit in. There are other technicalities, but let's say basically the shape is what I'm really fond of. If that amphora would have, let's say, given exchange of taste, then I would never have used it, mm-hmm. because I want, what I search for is pureness in wine, the expression of territory, and so the amphoras are doing exactly that.
Yeah, wow. Well, I think you have achieved this pureness and expression of territory. I absolutely find your wines to be thrilling and delicious and beautiful, and whereas in the first couple of vintages, there would be, I think, a lot of variation bottle to bottle in terms of some bottles being delicious and other bottles being less delicious. Now there's variation in the good kind, where they're generally all delicious, but they're just alive and they express a little bit differently bottle to bottle, which I think is a really nice thing. And they're pure, they're alive, they're beautiful wines, and so excited to have you on the show.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you so much. That's been Frank Cornelison on In the Drink. Oh, that's so exciting. Thanks so much for listening. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.